Our next speaker is our dear friend, Chuck Baird, who, as I mentioned before, is professor of economics and co-chairman of the economics department at California State University and director of the Smith Center for Private Enterprise. He received his PhD in economics from the University of California, Berkeley. He's been a Woodrow Wilson Fellow and a Danforth Fellow. He's taught at UCLA, Stanford, and the University of the Witwatersrand.
Witwatersrand.
Professor Baird is a member of the board of directors also of the Mount Pelerin Society, which was founded by F.A. Hayek in 1947. He's a quarterly columnist for the magazine Ideas on Liberty. He serves on the editorial boards of three academic journals and is consultant on labor economics to the New Zealand Business Roundtable. He's the author of four textbooks, including Prices and Markets, Macroeconomics, Elements of Macroeconomics, and Elements of Microeconomics, as well as numerous monographs, including ones on advertising, unionism, rent control, and other areas. His articles have appeared in so many journals and magazines, I couldn't count them all. Anyway, it's a great pleasure to introduce Chuck Baird.
Thank you, David. Before I begin my remarks, I want to do one little commercial. Upstairs at the Smith Center table up there, there is this brochure that describes a program that we're doing in June. This actually supplements and complements what David's doing here at the Independent Institute. We have a program for teachers, including home teachers, on how to use Socratic seminars as an education tool. And this is free to teachers. And it is from June 25th to June 29th. And you can pick up these brochures upstairs, and if you are teachers, please look at them, and if you know teachers, please pass them on. Now, to my remarks here. I'd like to begin with a little anecdote from my own experience with Hayek. I met Hayek in 1977 when the Institute for Humane Studies, which now is in at George Mason University, but then was in Menlo Park? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Menlo Park, put on a two-week conference on Austrian economics at Mills College here in Oakland. Now, I was the director of that program, which overstates my significance because, in effect, that just meant that I was the gopher. I was the one who was supposed to make all of the pieces fit together. And one of the pieces that I was responsible for was to pick up Hayek from Berkeley, which I find astonishing. I don't know what they would do with Hayek at Berkeley. Remember, I got my PhD from Berkeley, and it's not Hayek-friendly up there. But anyway, I picked him up from Berkeley and drove him down to Mills College in my 1972 Volkswagen Beetle. I washed it that afternoon before I picked him up. Now, I was very nervous about this because, first of all, a Volkswagen Beetle didn't seem appropriate for such an august person, but also because I didn't want to go down in history as the one who was responsible for the accident in which Nobel laureate F.A. Hayek died, right? Well, in any case, I picked him up, I introduced myself to him, gave him my card, and we started the short journey down to Mills College. He's just a charming man. He quickly put me at ease, and he asked me about what sort of work I was doing in economics, and he actually seemed interested in my answers. Not all people are. except my students, of course. Now, we arrived safely at Mills College, and I escorted him to where he was to give his presentation, and the presentation went very well. Now, the next morning, I reintroduced myself to him and offered him another card. Now, that was a huge mistake. See, my thinking was that, well, no, I'm just kind of a background person, I'm just kind of a gopher, and I'm not sure he would remember me. But, of course, when I offered him my card for the second time, he misinterpreted that to say that I was suggesting that probably he didn't have a good memory. And he bristled, and he said, "Young man, I remember who you are." Then he paused, tried to look severe, and then he smiled, and he said, "I am surprised that one as young as you has trouble remembering what he did on the day before." That's the Hayek that I knew. I was at ease from that moment on. And there's a little ending to this story. In 1982, there was a general meeting of the Mont-Pelerin Society in Berlin, which I attended actually under the auspices of David Thoreau here, who at that time was president of the Pacific Institute, which is now called the Pacific Research Institute in San Francisco. And I came across Hayek in the course of the evening of the opening banquet. Every Mont-Pelerin Society meeting has an opening banquet. Of course, everybody has name tags on. So I approached him, and before I said anything, he said to me, now, mind you, the Mills College experience was 1977. This is 1982. He looked at my name tag, gave it an expression of recognition, and he said, Mr. Baer, I hope your memory has improved since our days together at Mills College. So, he's a great guy. He's a great guy. Now, there's another anecdote that I'd like to tell. This is not about my experience with Hayek, and actually, I found out tonight from Alan that this is in the biography. I didn't think it was in the biography. It's in the biography in a footnote. And I must confess, I read the biography, but I didn't read the footnotes. This book is put together very well. The footnotes are all at the end, so you don't have to be bothered with them, and I confess that I wasn't. So. But anyway, I heard this anecdote from Mike Walker, who is the president of the Fraser Institute in Canada. As Alan says in his biography, in 1984, Hayek was made a companion of honor by Queen Elizabeth. And in his audience with Queen Elizabeth, now, we've got to put this in historical context, because at this time, the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, and various offshoot organizations were very much involved in making London a hazardous place to be. So the Queen, in this audience, asked Hayek how to pronounce his name. Was it Hayek? Or was it Hayek? And he said, it's Hayek, like high explosives. Right. Well, I've been asked to comment on the significance of the economics of Hayek in the present and future struggle to preserve liberty. And I have two newspaper articles that are very recent, which illustrates that a lot of people in this world could benefit from a reading of Hayek. First, from the ANG newspapers, the Alameda Newspaper Group newspapers, on Sunday, May 6th this year, there was a story that said, its headline, National Labs Disagree with Bush on Energy. And it says, scientists at the country's national laboratories have projected enormous energy savings if the government takes aggressive steps to encourage energy conservation in homes, factories, offices, appliances, cars, and power plants. Imagine that. Now, one of the most important messages that people get from reading Hayek is that prices do things like that. Higher prices are precisely those things which get us to conserve voluntarily in the ways that are best for us and given us our own circumstances of time and place. But the scientists in the country's national laboratories have not read Hayek. And then the same article, quote, a lengthy and detailed report based on 3 years of work by five national laboratories said that a government-led efficiency program emphasizing research and incentives to adopt new technologies could reduce the growth in electricity demand by between 20% and 47%. Well, now again, imagine that. That's another rule of prices. A central theme of Hayek's economics is that prices convey information. Prices tell us what the relative scarcities are. Prices tell users to use less, tell suppliers to try to supply more, tell entrepreneurs to get into markets where prices are high relative to cost, and entrepreneurs to get out of markets where prices are low relative to cost. But this lengthy and detailed report based on 3 years of work by five national laboratories didn't understand that. Now, the second article Well, actually, it's the same paper. It's the second article, but it's the same paper on the same date, May 6th. This is a story about a man named Severin Borenstein, who is director of the University of California Energy Institute in Berkeley. And he's generally portrayed as a genius in this area. But in this article, it says that he sees the need for federal regulators to ensure that the market system treated consumers fairly. Now, it gets better. We didn't just say, oh, the market will take care of everything and walk away. He's talking here, of course, about the California energy crisis, you know, in this third world state that we live in. Similarly, Borenstein now believes that there is a need for more stringent federal regulation of the electricity industry. He believes that power generators have been taking advantage of California's electricity shortage and boosting prices to astronomical levels. Still, he doesn't vilify the companies that own power plants. And here's the interesting thing. Listen to this. This is a quote from him, Mr. Borenstein. Generators are out there to make as much money as they can, he says. That's how markets work. Our job is to design markets so that when they try to make as much money as they can, they end up doing things that are good for consumers. Now, anybody who has read Milton Friedman, F.A. Hayek, von Mises, or Gary Becker, or even my books, would understand that that's precisely what markets do. When people make money in free markets, they can only make it if they end up doing things that are good for their customers. Now, this is a statement by a person who's supposed to be a genius. As a director, he's the director of the University of California Energy Institute in Berkeley. You know, I often say that I have the best of both worlds. I have a Berkeley degree, but I have a UCLA education. Okay. My first job was an assistant professor at UCLA, and I came under the very wholesome influence of Armin Elchin and the crowd down there. Great people. They're the ones that introduced me to the free market. It was at UCLA that I first got introduced to Hayek. And unfortunately now, UCLA, because Armin Elchin has retired, Harold Demsetz has retired, several other good free market people have retired there. UCLA economics department has become but a mere shadow imitation of the Berkeley economics department, and that's really, in my opinion, a very sad occasion. But anyway, lack of understanding reigns supreme at Berkeley, even as it was true when I was there. Now, I agree with Alan that the most important contribution of Hayek to economics is the principle of the division of knowledge, and also the related idea of competition as a discovery procedure. I want to take a little exception to what Alan had to say about Mises and Hayek on the socialist calculation debate. I think that the two contributions there were really quite different. I mean, Mises started out the socialist calculation debate by pointing out that if you don't have markets, you can't have prices. And in particular, if you don't have markets for capital goods, you can't have prices, because prices are things that emerge in markets. And without prices, of course, the planners cannot calculate. They don't know whether to build a building of cement or wood or steel or whatever, as Alan said. That was Mises' view. The process by which prices do coordinate economic activities. In so doing, he came to understand, as Alan does suggest, he came to understand that price formation is inescapably caught up in the subjectivity of the costs and benefits. So that when Abel Lerner, by the way, Abel Lerner was on my dissertation committee at Berkeley. So when Abel Lerner and Oscar Lange came up with the market socialist, isn't that a contradiction in terms? Market socialist. Yeah, that was a market socialist solution to the challenge that Mises put out in 1921, where there would be trying to find prices by trial and error. That is, they appreciate, that's why Mises was supposed to get this statue in the Great Hall of Socialist Heroes, because they came to understand that prices are important. While Longa and Lerner came up with this model by which the planners would solve that problem very easily. They would simply cry out prices at random, right? That's actually going to Val Ross, but that language. Cry out prices at random and then see, all right, is the price too low? We'll know if the price is too low because the amount wanted will be greater than the amount that's available. Then we'll raise prices. And if the price that we cry out is too high, we'll know that too because the amount available will be greater than the amount that people want. So we'll lower prices. The only trouble is, of course, that in the market, as it actually functions, nobody is setting price. Well, there are price setters, but in the market, there are all kinds of people trying all kinds of prices, but these prices are based upon individual bits of knowledge. Here we go with the division of knowledge again. Individual bits of knowledge and understanding of circumstances of time and place. And the other point to be made here, I'm going too fast, but that's okay, is the question of incentives. The role of what prices do in a free market is because prices affect what is in the best interest of the individual decision makers. Within a socialist setting, that incentive effect is absent. So Hayek, I think, went beyond Mises. He complemented Mises. He developed the role of prices more deeply than Mises did in the socialist calculation debate. The division of knowledge idea began as an argument against central economic planning. It developed into a description of how prices and profits coordinate economic activities in free markets. And it gave rise to Hayek's understanding of the spontaneous order. Now we realize that the idea of the division of knowledge and spontaneous order has a lot to say about the regulatory practices of the mixed economy today. The watermelon crowd. Do you know what I mean by that? Yeah, well, it's an expression that was actually coined, as far as I know, by the late Warren Brooks. Watermelon people. Green on the outside, pink on the inside, you know? Well, there is a watermelon crowd, and actually, as I look at the political landscape in the United States today, it is environmentalism. Environmentalism that is the biggest threat to our individual economic liberties. It is the environmental excuse that is used more often than any other excuse to justify planning not for the whole economy, but planning in particular sectors of the economy, which is just as deadly. Just as deadly. That is a contemporary use of the notion of the division of knowledge and the impossibility of central economic planning. It's not just central economic planning like they had with the Soviet five-year plans, but it's actually central economic planning of even parts of the economy, because the planners simply cannot know. Not because they're dumb, and not because they're bad people. They could be very good people. They can be very intelligent people, but the fact is, with a necessary knowledge, the knowledge that people have to have in order to make plans that work, in order to make plans that are consistent with reality, doesn't exist anywhere in its entirety. It's scattered out in bits and pieces. This is almost a direct quote from Hayek's 1945 piece, The Use of Knowledge in Society. It's scattered out there. And the only way that all of that relevant knowledge can be used is if everybody can play a part. And the only way that everybody can play a part is if we have a free economy. Now, Israel Kirzner, who is another hero of mine, I also met Israel Kirzner at that 1977 Mills College seminar for the first time.
Israel is best known for his work on entrepreneurship.
And he claims, in excessive modesty, he claims that everything that he has written is actually in Mises. Well, it isn't. I mean, a lot that Israel has done is original Israel Kirzner, but a lot of what Kirzner has done is also in Hayek, and it's not in Mises. One of the best pieces that Kirzner has ever written, and by the way, I'm very sad to say that Israel Kirzner has announced that on January of 2002, he's retiring from the economics profession. Israel is an Orthodox rabbi, and he has decided he's going to leave economics, going to retire from his professorship at the university, at New York University, and devote his full attention to his religious pursuits. I wish him well, but it's going to be a great loss to lovers of freedom. One of the best pieces that Kirzner wrote was a piece called The Perils of Regulation, a Market Process Approach. And I can't take the time to go over the arguments there, but all of the points that he made, essentially there are four sections of that paper. One is what he called undiscovered discovery. That's based upon Hayek's competition as a discovery procedure. Unsimulated discovery, stifled discovery, superfluous discovery, all of that is Hayek. It's all Hayek. So Kirzner owes a great debt to Hayek, which he acknowledges, notwithstanding that he insists that everything that he's written is really in Mises. Now, at a bare minimum, I think that every life-arranging politician of both parties, because the Republicans are not any better than the Democrats on this. It may be just a question of degree, and sometimes the Republicans are worse than the Democrats. But every life-arranging politician of any political party, I believe, should have to prove that they have read and understand the following pieces. Economics and Knowledge, these are Hayek's pieces. Economics and Knowledge, 1937, this is where the idea of the division of knowledge was first introduced. Followed up by The Use of Knowledge in Society, which was in 1945, and that was published in the American Economic Review, actually, and I think it was the September issue in 1945. Here's one that Alan doesn't mention, but I think is very important, and that's The Confusion of Language and Political Thought, which was written in published in 1967. And then Competition as a Discovery Procedure in 1968. The Pretense of Knowledge in 1974. That was his Nobel lecture. That when people get the Nobel Prize, they get to talk. Some people make more sense than others. And Hayek made a lot of sense in this piece, which has been published, it's been published in many places. It's in one of his collection of papers called, I think, New Studies in Philosophy and Economics. New Studies in Politics, Philosophy, and Economics. Thank you. After The Pretense of Knowledge, they should read his last book, The Fatal Conceit. I think all of these people should have to read these and demonstrate that they understand. They don't have to agree with it. Just demonstrate that they understand what is said in there before they can take their oath of office. Yeah? Imagine. Boy, that would be fun. Now, I would recommend that these same pieces, I mean, this is just an indication of how important I think Hayek is. I think these same pieces should be required reading in every school of journalism, and every school of law. At the very least, with respect to journalism, an understanding of Hayek would permit these journalists to understand perhaps the right questions to ask of those, quote, madmen in authority who know nothing of economics and seem to be proud of their ignorance. The Fatal Conceit, I think, which is more about, rather than economics and how markets work, it's more about the evolution of societies. I think that gives great pause to all of those who would seek to redesign society in their own image. Now, David just gave me a note here to tell me to shut up. No, he told me I have one more minute. And so I'm going to skip one section of what I had here, actually two sections. I want to come to the last thing that I wanted to say. I enjoyed Alan's book immensely. I learned a lot of things about Hayek that I simply didn't know. Fascinating life. If you read that book, you will enjoy it. You will learn a lot. You'll learn a lot that's valuable. And I agree with almost all that Alan says. I have a little problem with the role of money, as he said I might talk about, but I'm going to skip over that because I don't have time. But I want to get to something that I think is really substantial, a disagreement I have with Alan. On page 199, Alan tells us that Jefferson's statement in the Declaration of Independence that, quote, all men are created equal, unquote, is inconsistent with Hayek's case for inequality. The case for inequality that Hayek makes in the Constitution of Liberty. I think that's just wrong. I think that's a misreading of the situation. And I think the best way to see that is to go to page 87 of the Constitution of Liberty. And let me close by just making this quote from Hayek. From the fact that people are very different, it follows that if we treat them equally, the result must be inequality in their actual position, and that the only way to place them in an equal position would be to treat them differently. Equality before the law, which was what Jefferson was talking about in the Declaration of Independence, equality before the law and material equality are therefore not only different, but they are in conflict with each other, and I agree with Hayek on that, and I cordially disagree with Alan on that. Thank you very much.